The main difference is Unity really relies on you having to use C# pretty much right away to get anything that you would like done. Whereas with Unreal, there's a lot of things that are sort of pre-done for you and facilitate things such as, you know, the blueprints, which is the visual scripting, that make it so for you to make a game, depending on the circumstances, if you have no coding experience, Unreal tends to be a lot more plug and play. I think when you see all the stuff about virtual art departments and the big LED walls, you can clearly see that that is doable, but the amount of preparation and the amount of cost that goes into that, and then you've committed to what you've shot, that's quite, I don't know that every director is going to want to do that. Ray tracing is real time, but it's slow in real time, you know? It's like, it's so you're kind of in a halfway house doing that kind of thing with the real-time rendering, where, yeah, in certain circumstances, it's perfect. It'll, like, do the job, it'll be editable, it'll be great. But then you still see the pixelation on screen because the rays have to calculate, and you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, it's like, you can't get away from the math there. It's sort of like the calculations that need to be done. I think a lot can be done to achieve this. The most important thing is for people to be proactive about making a change, right? And recognizing that we have an issue of representation in the industry and actively pushing for, different candidates and giving them preference because they need to be given an opportunity. And, you know, not just from their background, but because there's incredibly talented people out there.
Hi, and welcome to the VFX Artist Podcast. On today's episode, I have Felipe Magalhães, real-time supervisor at Envis. During today's discussion, we do a deep dive on Unreal Engine and real-time workflows, as well as touch base on Felipe's journey into the industry, education, diversification, and representation in the VFX industry. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the show, Felipe.
Thank you very much, Kofi. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. I've been looking to have you on for a while because, we've worked together, and lately Unreal is like the new hip.
Yeah.
Or the new cool kid in college, for if you could, you would say. So, and I think you're the man to bring on to just discuss it. I wanted to touch on Unreal, but I think before we get into Unreal, I just wanted to get a bit of your journey, of your background. So just to start off, just tell us just a bit about yourself and just what your current role is, I guess.
Sure. So currently I'm a real-time supervisor at Envis. Mm-hmm. My journey started really about 14 or so years ago when I started learning 3D, because I've always been interested in video games. And that's, I guess, an important part of where I am this day, because my focus has always been sort of on the games industry, not necessarily VFX. And I began my career mostly as a freelance 3D artist, just a modeler, doing hard surface stuff, and then progressing to a character sculpting. I was also really, really passionate about teaching, so I had a bit of a stint working with companies like Digital Tutors, who's now Pluralsight, and focused a lot on anatomy, character creation, and trying to kind of bring up people that were coming up, you know, generations after me, to sort of have good training and a overall nicer experience when sort of delving into the complex world of 3D and modeling and all this other stuff. So I was freelancing in Brazil for a very long time. Basically for about 10 years of my career, I was a freelancer, mostly working for animated trailers, like mobile games, that kind of thing. So my specialty was always a little bit on optimization and sort of how to make things low poly and basically understanding limitations of game engines like Unity, Unreal to an extent later, but it was mostly trying to you know, if you think about 10 years ago, what your phone could do compared to what your phone can do now, there's a lot of sort of restrictions on hardware and things like that. So I, a few years ago, applied for a job at Third Floor, which I was then hired by a lovely Jamie Palmer.
That's where we met.
Indeed, that's where we met. And yeah, I had a good year and a bit with them. And I had a really good time, learned a lot about Previs because it was my first job in VFX, really. But I had a lot of experience sort of managing teams, outsourcing art, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, sort of like kind of fell in love with Previs because of the speed and, you know, the amount of agency that you have and how instrumental it is to sort of staging and storytelling and mm-hmm. helping people make good decisions for filmmaking, right? After my period at Third Floor, I went to The Mill for a short stint because while at the Third Floor, I joined the VR team because I had a background in game assets and I knew how to work with things for the game engines. Because when you're working Previs and just Maya, you're a lot freer. And so we didn't have a lot of artists at the time that were sort of able to transition between the Previs side and the VR team side with the game that they were developing. And so there I met a bunch of really amazing, talented people, programmers, technical artists, other animators, good friends that I've had to this day. And that's where it sort of sparked my love for Unreal. I had this really awesome talk with, it was David Hibbets from Epic. He came to Framestore because at the time Third Floor and Framestore were in the same building. And so I was offered the opportunity to go for this talk. I went for the talk. And at the end of it, where he was showing, it was basically the white paper for Fortnite, where they did the whole trailer for Fortnite in Unreal and showed Sequencer and how they made all the camera, like all the effects in real time, all that stuff, like using Alembic caches for the facial animation, those kinds of things. At the end of the presentation, I walked up to David Hibbets and I said, so, hey, I'm a Unity guy, you know, most of my experience is in there. What do I need to do to learn Unreal? And he gave me a course suggestion. And I basically, for about 8 or 9 months, every day after my commute from, at the time it was Chancery Lane, I basically got home and I studied Unreal and I built my own games. And I absolutely fell in love with programming and visual scripting and blueprints. And basically my passion for Unreal grew from there. It effectively changed my life because I, within a few months, transitioned to being an artist who could also code a bit, which then starts bridging gaps between departments and becomes really, really important. And that's when I decided that I wanted to be a technical artist. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of room for that kind of position where I wanted to go. And that's where I found an opportunity at The Mill. I had a short stint there. We had some really, really cool projects, really challenging things that we needed to do because of hardware limitations on phones and filters. And again, all based off of game using Unreal or a specific software for Facebook that they were using for filters, right. I think. So I had a good 6 months there. It was a really good time. And then an opportunity appeared for Envis, where you and I, where we met, working on The Witches. Hugh McDonald and Yannick Lender, our head of Viz at the moment, reached out to me, offered me a position to work with the Unreal and asset side of that project. And the rest is basically history now, because I went from... I basically built all, we had a collaboration with Method Studios on that project where they built part of the assets, but then pretty much everything else was sort of handled by us. And so I built pretty much all of the assets there. And then I had the opportunity to work with amazing people like, you know, Ryan Began, Hugh McDonald, Eduardo Schmidick, was a good friend of mine, where they, I've just had this incredible opportunity to learn and grow. And since then, it's just been a lot of programming, a lot of Unreal, a lot of automation and just making things good. So hopefully that's a good summary of things of like how I got to where I got to.
But I want to actually dig deep down. I go back a bit, step back a bit. I just want to find out a bit more about how, like, when you first realized you had a creative flow or like interest?
So I think it was when I realized I wasn't doing so well at school because I just didn't get the sort of education system. Mm-hmm. And I still have my own sort of criticisms about how we bring people up in our society. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't fit me. The sort of teaching method, teaching style, you know, every artist says that, or, you know, maybe not every artist, I won't generalize, but let's just say that possibly a lot of artists say that they're not good at maths, right? Mm-hmm. And there's no reason for that to be the case. It's like, oh, I just don't, you know, it's just, I'm just not good at that stuff. And it turns out that it's all about people who teach you, right? And so for me, I never got those other sort of subjects when it came to maths and, you know, like the more complicated stuff, because there was never any practical, you know, example of how you'd use these things, these theorems and all this other stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so I always loved drawing. I was always drawn to that. Absolutely loved video games. You know, my first sort of video game, like I remember, was playing the original Doom, where we had all the floppy disks. You know, my dad used to work for basically computer companies, so he had access to really sort of, you know, high-end hardware at the time. You know, things like Intel for like 486 and things like that, you know, way back in the day. So that's really where my creativity sort of came through. I started my journey in photography. I really, really liked doing photography. And from there, it was just sort of a passion for games, photography, and just art in general, where is sort of how I got my, you know, foot in this direction, really.
Yeah. So how then did you decide, or like how then did you fall into what the VFX industry? I guess you've touched a bit on it, but would you say gaming and just photography were the main catalyst for that?
Absolutely. I think I've always loved movies, and I've always loved animation, and in general, just 3D. I was always fascinated by games that really focused on visual storytelling. And, you know, to me, I was always one of those guys like, oh, there's so many of these games that could be movies, you know, because there's such rich, incredible stories. And so for me, my intention was always to work in the games industry as a freelancer, but the opportunity just arose for VFX. And it was really just a happy coincidence of, like, I was looking to get out of Brazil, which is where I'm from. And I have a dual citizenship because my dad's family is all Italian. Mm-hmm. So I was just applying at the time. I was the industry in Brazil is really, really small. Okay. And that is for both games and for the film industry. So there wasn't a lot of options. And, you know, I started just applying places. And yeah, it's mm-hmm. I just got lucky.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Amazing. So I'm very curious about Unreal and Unity. Like, what's the difference between the two, and why has the previous and post-viz VFX and virtual production departments just adopted Unreal over Unity?
So that is a question with a lot of layers, but the best way to describe, I think, the main differences is that Unreal has always been more laser focused on making games, and thus all of their systems and, say, templates and training content and everything that they've done has always been geared towards games. Like, for example, you have specific third person camera template levels, or, you know, blank top down shooter levels. They were they always sort of been a little bit more focused on a single thing, whereas with Unity is a very open engine where you can make web applications, phone applications, games, mm-hmm. PC applications. You can do so much with Unity in a sense, but the main difference is Unity really relies on you having to use C# pretty much right away to get anything that you would like done. Whereas with Unreal, there's a lot of things that are sort of pre-done for you and facilitate things such as, you know, the blueprints, which is the visual scripting, that make it so for you to make a game, depending on the circumstances, if you have no coding experience, mm-hmm. Unreal tends to be a lot more plug and play. And personally, for me, a lot more artist friendly with the interface. And again, that's just my personal opinion. I think both engines have their strengths and weaknesses for that matter. So that's sort of part of it, where in my experience, a person who can program in Unity, they can do a lot, like a really considerable amount. And it's very flexible. And I know a lot of developers on both ends of the spectrum with Unreal or Unity that sometimes gravitate towards Unity because of that flexibility, because it's sort of like a framework that you can put on top of. But it, as much of an advantage as it is a disadvantage because you have to build everything that you don't have, or try to find things sort of, and you know, try to bolt it into your code. I think Unity is much more, in my perspective, a service that they're trying to offer, where they basically say to the users, hey, we're providing you this tool. You can, you know, do what you want with it. You know, it's you, the world is your oyster. Whereas Unreal says, hey, you want to make games? We'll get you to the shortest sort of possible, you know, distance to get to your realization of your goals as quickly as we can. So other main differences are that with the sort of lighting engine in Unreal, I believe that there is a little bit more superiority in the quality that you can reach in Unreal with ease. You know, you could do the same thing, like visually speaking, in Unity that you could do in Unreal, but I believe in Unreal it's a lot more, again, user-friendly. And it keeps coming back to that, right? As an artist that didn't know how to program when I first started trying to code in Unity way back in the day, it was something that I was like, oh, this isn't quite as intuitive as I would expect, whereas Unreal is pretty much built for artists to collaborate and work together on a project, right? Mm-hmm. So that's another aspect of it as far as usability for, my opinion, artists to collaborate on projects, how to make materials and material instances. And, you know, just in general, there's a lot of thought on the collaboration of how you would build, say, a game project. Mm-hmm. And so I think the reason that the VFX industry has gravitated towards Unreal is first and foremost because Epic has invested a lot of effort into supporting the games industry, the VFX industry, with its tools and its content. It specifically built that Fortnite white paper and went to Framestore and went to all these other, you know, companies and said, hey, you should use Unreal because look, you could just turn the slider and then, you know, time of day changes, or you could just move this character and do all this. And, you know, all the changes are there. You don't have to wait to see your result. You're just seeing it instantly, right? So hopefully that gives you a bit more of a, you know, clearer answer, but I'm happy to delve deeper into any other aspects that you like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, just generally, like, what do you generally use Unreal for, and how does the workflow differ between previous and Postgres, and maybe like VFX and all virtual production? Because they're all quite different, I guess.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because at Envis, what we do is we've merged a lot of our workflows together because it kind of makes sense. You know, a lot of what we do is our animation and obviously asset work is made in a DCC such as Maya, for example. So we still build the previs traditionally where you would in Maya. But then what we do is we take advantage of the incredible speed with which you could render sequences, as well as the visual fidelity that you can achieve with, you know, explosions, effects, particles, skin, hair, clothes, etc., to basically use Unreal as a rendering sort of pass on what we do for our previs. So all of our previs is done in Unreal, for example. And so it's just a natural workflow. If you do all your shots and all your work in Maya, and then we have a really solid pipeline that basically we built on the witches, in fact, you know, a large part of it, that takes everything that we do in Maya and immediately syncs it to Unreal so that you can just scrub through everything you've seen in Maya, in Unreal, all your cameras, and then you can do any tweaks that you need. So it's a really sort of, it's a two-stage process where we focus on the animation, we focus on, you know, the staging of things, and then we render it out in Unreal and sort of add that visual sort of, you know, extra to it. So that's one part of what we do on the previous side, for example. But The other thing that we can do, for example, is because we have a lot more high fidelity lighting and say clouds, weather, you know, particle systems, like you could literally turn a slider and then it goes from midday to magic hour. And you can have really, really important discussions with DOPs, directors, VFX supervisors. It's really sort of all a part of the same thing. So before you even start the previs, we staging, we build the characters, we put the environment into Unreal, and we drop cameras in. And you can do virtual camera scouting, or you could do just regular staging where you just place things in a chess piece manner, and you line up your lenses and you figure out what you want to do. In fact, I just did that yesterday, 2 days in a row with the project that I'm working on. So that's the part of pre-production that I think is really important, where Unreal lets you just take something from art department. You usually have to clean it up because that's just how it is, because, you know, unfortunately, there's still a disconnect between, you know, obviously art department has to build things to a very specific spec. And then they have their own tools like, you know, Rhino, CAD, those kinds of things, right? And then we use Maya, and then there's no real financial incentive for those companies to necessarily talk to each other as far as like, ah, we should just make a nice bridge for all your things to come in. And, you know, so what we do is we use sort of Unreal to be that bridge for us, where Unreal really is very lenient about what it accepts. You can kind of chuck a lot of stuff into Unreal, very high poly. Where, for example, if you take something from art department, like let's say a massive spaceship or something like that, super highly detailed, full of polygons, you know, millions and millions and millions, you can chuck it into Unreal and it just gobbles it up and it's like, yeah, I'm fine, you know, which if you did in Maya, you'd have really slow viewports and there's just nothing you can do. And that's not even talking about lighting and texturing or anything like that, right? Mm-hmm. So there's an incredible agility that comes with being able to do staging and previs and in general virtual production in Unreal, because it's all about that being in the moment with the decision makers that are working with you on the TV show or the film, whatever it is that you're working on, and just letting them drive and say, ah, you know, but what if we want to backlit these characters when they're inside, you know, this structure? Am I going to see that? Are they shaded here? Or, you know, where's the sun going to hit them in the hands or the feet, that kind of thing? It's a really, really important and reactive way of working, which I think is really, really awesome. So that's the pre-production side of things. When it comes to post-viz, that's the beauty of still working in Unreal, because generally speaking, you can use your previs assets in post-viz. You just work them up a little bit more, right? You have a bit more time to do lighting, because in previs, sometimes there's clients that's like, look, I need a crowd shot. I just need gray characters moving, and I just want the single hero character. So it's not necessarily the most representative thing. And it's sometimes a challenge for some clients to sort of see through the previs, like see it for what it is and sort of imagine how it's going to be on the day, right? Like, I think that's a big challenge that, it's always that gap where we're trying to bridge of like, you need to see past the sort of not finished environment because art department hasn't finished it and you still haven't approved it, you know, Mr. or Miss Director, you know, like it's one of those things that you're like, oh yeah, but that ship is, you know, sometimes like as an example, you throw a bit of animation in instead of just chess piece pieces and like, well, they're not really going to move like that. And it's like, well, don't focus on the animation. Don't worry about the animation. Let's, you know, it's a difficult sort of like balance that you have to strike about what do we focus on to kind of get to the most sort of positive outcome and the most sort of productive outcome for the production in general, right? So coming from that, where you have all your assets, let's say you've done all your previs, you've done all your virtual cameras, you've done your scouting, your staging, everything like that. You have a bunch of renders. You've got a whole cut, you know, on the show that I'm working on, we have a previs scene that's actually like 10 and a half minutes. Full previs, which is quite astounding. So you have all of that, you have all this information, and then you do tech viz, right? So even before post viz, when you're gonna, you know, shoot things, tech viz is a really important part, right? Whereas in Unreal, you could do the same thing of like, okay, how, you know, can you measure the distance of this camera? Where is everything? Put the green screen in. Let's see. Oh, what if you move this green screen there? Okay, are these set pieces movable? is this going to be in camera? Okay, it's not going to be in camera. We'll need to go over this person's shoulder. Or like, there's so many details that like you can sort of surmise from that part of the pre-production that then goes just to the day before of shooting, right? And sometimes to the day of shooting, where you give everybody this information. It's in real time. Somebody's like, hey, how big is this? You open it up, measure it. Here you go. Immediate, send a message 5 minutes later, right? That agility is really important. So you have all your previs assets. You have your sort of mini cut of the sequences you're going to work on, full CG or not. And then you get your plates. So there's a couple ways of doing things now. So obviously there is a composure in Unreal where you could bring your plates in, or, and then obviously composite things on top. It's a system that isn't as fleshed out as it could be currently. I think it's something that is, from what I remember, under revision at Epic. I do believe they're going to be updating what composure is and sort of what compositing can be in Unreal. So you have that with that system, which is what we did on the Witches, because obviously you did a lot of the tracking, right? And so I remember I built a tool that allowed us to sort of roto in Maya, and then we would bring that into Unreal as like a mask, you know, a garbage mat or something like that, and then we were able to basically just use it as a renderer with composure and link it to the plate. So that system still works. So it's still the same workflow, Maya, or, you know, track wherever you're going to do your tracking nowadays. There's lots of options, right? And so we can still use that system, or you have just your assets and you can just provide CG elements, right? And so you track your cameras, you bring them into Unreal, you have your environment, you render it out, you make it as pretty as you can. Obviously, with the advent of ray tracing, is something that you can consider to even like up the quality, get some more global illumination, which is where Unreal 5 is really going to come in and I think really change the game for things, because with Lumen and the whole sort of new lighting system, as well as the what they're doing with Nanite with the mesh sort of tessellation system, like the dynamic system that they have for LODs and working with really, really high quality things, you can see where it's going to start blurring the lines of where post this, you know, because sometimes, I mean, I'm sure you've seen it as well, Kofi, where sometimes post this goes to finals, you know, like sometimes there's some shots and it's like, yeah, that's good enough. And then it just goes through, right? Mm-hmm. So on our perspective, on the post this side, we use the exact same pipeline. It's just a different output. Instead of outputting, say, QuickTimes and DNX HDs, or, you know, with the burn-ins and everything else what the client wants, we output EXRs and we output foreground layers, background layers, elements, anything that you need. And you can basically, within Unreal, build a system of those stencil layers and passes and everything that you'd like depth pass, reflection pass, those kinds of things like opacity masks, etc. You output EXRs, goes into the nuke side of things for comping. You know, it's a really important discussion to have about, say, your color pipeline when you are working in Unreal, because Unreal is obviously linear, so sRGB, right? And then I'm no like color expert, but obviously, you know, depending on your output of being ASUS or, you know, Rec 709, there's a lot for you to sort of consider where you need to decide where your ground truth is, whether it is in Nuke or is it in Unreal? Like, you know, are you going to match like a Macbeth chart or like a color wheel? Or how do you know that, you know, the sRGB that's in Unreal, when it gets converted to ASUS, then comes into Nuke, telling Nuke that it's like, hey, this was sRGB converted to ASUS, but it was output sRGB, not, you know, utility sRGB or something like that, you know. So setting up your viewport, finding those ground truths, it's its own pipeline in and of itself, right? Mm-hmm. But then the process just kind of continues. You can set up scripts and sort of, you know, from Unreal, our system generates the EXRs, they go into the server, you get a shot grid notification, the compers know that the shot is ready, they pick up the shot, and sometimes we can just auto-comp it, depending on the situation. If you just want to do A over B, and you already have the plate set up, and, you know, cut out everything, E-keyed, etc., nicely done, it just becomes sort of an automated process, where the person who hits render in Unreal, then just waits for a quick time to be generated on the server a few minutes later, and that's, I think, the biggest advantage, again, is the render times.
Right.
It is absolutely incredible the amount of sort of content that we churn through on sort of like a day-to-day on previs and post-viz and anything else that we do, because of the speediness of rendering in Unreal. And we're talking, you know, something like, you know, 300 frames get done in, you know, 4 minutes. And that's like EXRs with like proper, really high anti-aliasing and all, you know, as the highest possible quality. And then like thinking about something like that, like, oh, wow, you know, 500 frames, you know, you know, a few minutes, it's really quite ground, like earth shattering, right? In a way. And it allows the artist to be a bit more bold when it comes to, I'm going to try this, you know? Because if you think about it, if you set something to render, it's going to, well, going to go get my cup of coffee. And it's like, okay, everybody, I'll talk to you tomorrow because it's going to render for like 3 days. And then you realize that you've left like a red ball on the corner and, you know, you're like, oh no, you know, in Unreal, it's very easy to see because you can see the preview of the render and, you know, we use sort of separate boxes to obviously do render farms, that kind of thing, multiple processes at the same time. So all our shows run that way. And that's really it. So like, it's a really amazing unifier, I think, of all of the disciplines, and everybody just kind of starts to come together. And for me, it's incredibly exciting because then you get to interact with all everybody from every department, right? And then that's where you can learn, right? Because we can't all know everything. We can know, we can have our specialties, right? But I know who to go to if I want to ask a color question, or I know who to go to if I want to ask, like, hey, you know, is this going to be, you know, enough coverage for what we're trying to do? You know, do we need to overscan the plate, or like, what is it that the client needs, etc.? You know, so yeah, hopefully that gives you a good overview of like how we work with Unreal, sort of pretty as a central part of our pipeline at Envis.
It's amazing because I was very curious about the rendering times, because I was just imagining, like, because you're getting everything in real time. And I was just thinking about the rendering stages. I hadn't considered how quick it'd be.
Like, For Previs, for example, sometimes it's like 20 seconds. For like, you know, a thousand frames will take a little bit of time, but like no more than a couple minutes. But like, if you have a shot that's like 100 frames, it just goes and done, and it goes into the server and gets converted into quick time, and you're done. You know, like, it's incredibly quick.
So I just want to step back a bit and just talk a bit about The Witches, just because we were, or at least you were most of the time working quite a lot of the time with the director. So I'm just wondering what were the common requests or demands that specifically on the show or for The Witches, or actually on different shows that you've worked on, what are the common requests, as well as maybe you can maybe touch base on a bit of like what was required for The Witches, like what your involvement was and what was required.
Sure. So on, I think it's important to state that every project is different and has their own like specific set of things that they want to achieve, right? And so I can very easily say that I think projects may fall into maybe like one to like two to three categories. So you have projects like, for example, Witches or Midnight Sky that we worked on, where it was really important just to sort of figure out the staging and do basically all of the shots, all of the cameras, everything digitally. And so the workflow is completely different. We animate, we don't do any cameras. We gave Mr. Zemeckis the virtual camera system that we had. He was surrounded by, you know, I think it was three, I don't remember if it was four monitors or if it was three. He was basically surrounded by, I think it was three. And so we had the sort of, you know, little rig for the virtual camera, and he wanted it, you know, we use the iPad, there's lots of ways of doing it, so different directors like different things, but he liked the weight and the heft of having it as if it was a camera, because he felt like he could do his moves a little bit more naturally. And so for that project, it was all about giving him the most amount of freedom that we could to then realize the shots that he wanted to realize. So he had a specific vision, And what we needed to do is, obviously, we worked with the supervisor, Ryan Began, there, where he directed us of like, hey, this is where the shots are going to go. We've had this discussion. So, you know, I remember specifically one of the things that Mr. Zemeckis said was that, oh, you know, we were animating the mice running in the hallway. And he said, well, they're sort of in the middle of the hallway. That's not what mice do. You should put them on the skirting boards, for example, right? So those kinds of things of like, he wants to direct the CG as much as he could. And, you know, a lot of what we did on The Witches, like, it was like a very, very big part of the movie. We previewed basically the entirety of it, right? Mm-hmm. Because obviously there was just so much effects work with all the mice there. So that was the requirement sort of on that project, where it was like really, really large, long animation sequences. I think one of the sequences that we worked on, I remember the animator JD, it was like 5,000 frames, mm-hmm. and it was the sequence where they're all at the dinner table having the pea soup, and they all start shooting up into the sky, and we had like, I think 100 rigs in that scene, because you have to have 50 witches down this big table, and then they have to go into the sky, they have to pop, and then you have them turn into sort of clothes, and then you got mice coming out. It was absolute, like, that sequence stressed our capabilities to the like highest possible like
right.
levels, because of it was really like heavy requirements, both for workload mm-hmm. as well as the like how do we keep this performance in the game engine, as well as, you know, how do we get this to be something that we can iterate on, when it's like, oh, we've changed the action 5,000 frames, and you don't want your animator to suddenly just sink in his chair and, you know, consider his life choices, as it were. When you're like, yeah, no, the whole action's changed, and he just spent a week blocking out, you know, a huge sequence like that. So mm-hmm. for us, that is the most of the requirement on The Witches was every sequence that we went through the beats. We had boards, and we basically tried to match the boards like with the action of the characters. And we said, okay, it was the most important thing there was timing, right? It's like, okay, let's think about this scene actually running in real time and saying how many, you know, people needed to act it out and say, okay, now they're talking to each other. How long before they move into this other part of the conversation? And so we had to, because the sequences were so long, is because we were basically pre-vising the whole movie, like beat by beat as it needed to go. So that was, hopefully that answers a bit of the questions on what the requirements mm-hmm. were for The Witches on our end, for virtual production side of things, where it was all about the getting the director the tools he needed to get his shots out.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is, for example, my project right now that I'm working on, which is the three-body problem, where I'm the previous supervisor. Mm-hmm. I'm working very closely with the effects supervisor, and it's a very different dynamic where we still do our cameras in Maya, and we do our blocking to the boards, and we still follow the beats, and we read the script, and, you know, we do basically traditional previs. But then what happens is Stefan goes in and makes some changes, because he's got so much experience of like what should be in camera, where we can save, and just in general, like kind of assists us with, he kind of likes to do his own cameras, you know. So right. this particular, it's not the director that is doing the cameras, because we're just working on the VFX side of things, right? In this case, it is the VFX supervisor, and he's getting really his hands dirty in Unreal, because it's so sort of, like I said, easy to use and approachable, right? You open up the sequencer in Unreal, you hit the little camera button, all of a sudden you can pilot it around, you set a couple keyframes, and you got your camera move. And, you know, we do the camera move. Sometimes our camera moves go through all the way. Sometimes he's like, puts his own camera move in, and then they do a cut, show it to the director, he's like, I want it to go, you know, a bit lower here, or I want these people in frame, etc. He goes in and he changes it. And for him, it's a lot faster that he can do the cameras, that he doesn't have to like send us notes of like, oh, the director said this. He's like, no, it's fine, I'll do it. He likes, having this sort of ease of use to sort of realize the vision for the show, which I think is really great. And sort of, to again, assist the directors and like, you know, with everything that you have to consider within a VFX department, like budgets and, you know, how many shots you're allowed, those kinds of things,
yeah.
right? So that's another side of the dynamic. So I think those are just sort of like two shows that are like very specific, where some people can get hands-on like quite a bit. On the one hand, with say a virtual camera, and drop all your cameras in, and those are the cameras, and then we clean those up, right? On the witches, we took the cameras that Mr. Zemeckis did, and then we sort of did a pass of like filtering, because obviously there's going to be a little bit of shake and, you know, that kind of thing, right? And so on our end, on say the three body problem, we are building cameras, and those cameras just get edited in real time in Unreal as per the need of the shot and the showrunners and the directors and whatever else is necessary. And then on the other side, sort of like the third thing is where it's sort of the traditional thing of you do the previs, you do the cameras, you deliver the quick times, and they give you feedback, and they say, fix this, you fix it, you send it back, and there you go. So I think that's sort of like a good general overview.
So, what challenges would you technically have for shots that are not handheld in Unreal?
So, I think it depends, right? Because I guess when it comes to it kind of brushes up with tech viz, right?
Right.
In a sense, because sometimes you do the shots. You get the boards and you're like, okay, it's this top down angle. And then we look at it and it's like, camera's like 60 feet off the floor. Stage is 40 feet tall. Yeah. You can't do that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the arm doesn't reach. Like you can't. This is not how it works. So there is a level of give and take there where sometimes, you know, it's pre-production. You don't have all the information. It's just par for the course. But for the most part, it's quite easy to do, you know, you do dolly tracks or something. I was like, okay, I want to see this move I'm doing. How much track do I need? Mm-hmm. You know, and he says, oh, you need 60 feet of track. It's like, okay, that's a lot, but maybe we can kind of squeeze it if it's on this stage. And then if it isn't, it's like, okay, we'll have to do this move differently, right? Mm-hmm. So for the most part, it's not particularly challenging in the sense that we do the shot and then sometimes you just come to the conclusion like, Someone notices at the end and is like, I don't think we're going to be able to do that because, you know, we don't have that lens, or, you know, that's not big enough for the stage, or, you know, we're not building this part of the set, so you can't have that in camera or something like that. So it becomes a bit more tech busy when it comes to non-handheld stuff, but for the most part, it works really well and isn't like too complicated of a thing to do.
Cool. So from what I'm hearing, like, there's a lot of Unreal that you like, but what do you think it lacks or can be improved?
I think it's one of the things that I think it's fair to level at Epic is that they are a games company first, right? Mm-hmm. And I think while they have made and continue to make a lot of investment into the virtual production side of things and, you know, helping out VFX, I think their focus is and like always will be that they are a game engine, and that's kind of that's where their focus is. So I think the VFX side is a really nice bonus for them that they really like working with, and they certainly are nurturing. I always have to be careful about all the Epic people that I know listening to this podcast being like, Felipe, like, I'm sorry, listen, I know. I think one of the things that is common is that sometimes they will release a feature and then not necessarily support it all the way through to the end, right? They release a thing and say, hey, here's this cool thing. And you're like, cool. And then you start using it, and then it could be unstable, it could crash. There's things that I feel like sometimes you don't necessarily can get the support that you need, or, you know, that we've had it a few times where it's like, oh, we found a bug. And they're like, yes, that's totally a bug. Mm-hmm. We just wait for the next version. And you're like, oh,
I need now.
It's like, oh, well, yeah. So what you could do is you could like go get our, you know, source on GitHub and rebuild. It's like, no, but that means we have to do a lot of stuff on our end to like compile the engine and do all the stuff. And it's like, and then we're working with beta software, which you don't want to be doing. So I think that's the part where it's difficult sometimes to kind of find the balance of like, you know, I'll give you a very simple example, and I think a lot of VFX people will kind of relate, is that, hey, from, I believe it was from 4.25 to 4.26, we went to Python 3 in Unreal. But then Maya hadn't released, 2022 with Python 3. So then what you have is, suddenly now, if you want to get all the cool new stuff, like Sky Atmospherics and all the other stuff that started to come in 4.26 and so on, you're like, okay, so your whole pipeline is Python 2, but now Unreal's Python 3, and all the shiny stuff that you want to play with, it's like, you got to update your code base, and you're like, okay. So then you update your code base, which takes a good chunk of work and resources and, you know, lots of departments working together. And while you're doing this in production, while you're sort of supporting other shows, those kinds of things, it's sort of the nature of the system. Like, I think Unreal has in the past done a lot of releases very, very quickly, which then means that you have to really consider whether or not it's time to upgrade or not, because 99% of the things that Epic adds are really, really awesome and you want to use them. But there's sort of an inherent risk of, with any kind of software package, of jumping immediately to the newest and coolest, because you can run into stability issues. And sometimes there's just a bug and it's like, oh, you know, the focus distance on my camera, you know, like depth of field, you know, they changed how this variable was named. And now the script that I have that like sets the focus distance based off of Maya, it now breaks. So every camera that I bring into Maya going forward is just blurred. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh. So you have to go in and, you know, it's that kind of thing. I believe that on the support side, VFX is a really small part, and I think that's fair to say, on Epic's radar compared to everything else that they do, because they support ArcViz and all this other stuff, you know, automotive. There's many, many fronts where Epic is sort of pushing their, you know, their fronts and their marketing and the things that they want to do. And I think VFX is a big part of it, but we do tend to kind of sometimes get half-baked features, you know, like I said, you know, they released Composure and I don't recall it having get an update very recently. Again, I could be wrong here, but when we were on The Witches, they did say that they were going to, for example, rebuild it. So then what do you do? You just decide, do I put any resources into this knowing that it could be completely like gutted from the ground up, and then I'm using this thing, and then if they send me a new version, my process pipeline doesn't work anymore. Like, can you take that risk, or do you just go an alternate method? Like, okay, we'll just do CG plates and, you know, comp and nuke and not like circumvent this altogether. And then you just have like a little system of like, okay, you have like a comp checker in nuke, mm-hmm. whereas like your render's done, just open the scene, it loads it up. It's like, okay, cool. There's my plate. I can see it. Great. And then you send it off. Right. So I think that would be one of the things I would flag with like, that I've noticed that it's a thing of like, oh, you know, Niagara was in beta for like forever. It's their new particle mm-hmm. system. And it was in beta during The Witches. And I remember when Epic visited us and I was like, yeah, every time I try to use it, it crashes. And they're like, yeah, don't use it yet. And then a year down the line, we were still working on it. I was like, yeah, I still don't use Niagara because it was crashing. Because it was like still, I was like, oh, no, but it's better now. It's better now. And then it is now. It's super stable. It's awesome. So it just takes a bit of time to mature, right? So trying to be on the bleeding edge, you get cut, is mm-hmm. I guess what I'm trying to say, as you'd expect from mm-hmm. the word.
Yeah. So just how technical does one need to be when using Unreal like you do, as well as working with the director? Because you had quite a lot of roles, like you were, I think you were doing a bit of assets and also supervising it, as well as...
Exactly.
In Unreal, you were, I don't know, dealing with like cameras and then lighting and then
lighting, particles, everything.
Yeah, literally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess like for me, it's a little bit unfair of a comparison to make to possibly other people that use Unreal, but I wear way too many hats, possibly, you could argue. Right. But on The Witches, I was basically the lead asset person for Previz. I was also the Unreal technical artist. And so I had the most knowledge about how to interact with systems from sort of things like Maya, et cetera, how to build that pipeline, how to get that to work, you know, what kind of skeletal structure do you need? What kind of limitations do you have with like blend shapes, deformers, those kinds of things that you don't know. So you have to be fairly technical to do my current job as a real-time supervisor. I am, you know, an artist, but I'm a large part of my work is programming as well. So The most important thing I'd say is you need a very good general understanding of the engine's features and capabilities. And the best way to get that is to make games. And that's what I did. I built three or four games where I built like a pinball game, I built like a survival game, I built like a first-person game where I coded all the movement of like jumping, going forward, etc. You get a lot of experience with intercommunication of the systems inside Unreal. And that's really important because understanding how systems communicate with each other reveals to you their limitations, right? It's like, you can't do this because you can't have access to this thing. So where can I get access to this to do this thing that I need? It's like, well, where can I bring everybody together in the sequencer? How do I make a particle spawn in the sequencer? Well, if you're doing a cascade particle, it's one option on the component. If it's a Niagara particle, it's another option. It's like a life cycle track or something like that. And on the cascade particles, it's like a particle toggle track. And they're different. The life cycle track in Niagara is like a thing that you drag, like a timeline. And the toggle track is like a little keyframe that you goes from green to red, and then that's when the particle lives. You know, so there's lots of little technical nuances, as a, you know, a simple example like that goes of like, okay, where is your sort of, you know, aspect ratio controls for the camera? Where do you put in, you know, the black bars and, you know, set your, you know, 2, 3, 5, 2, 1, et cetera, right? Okay, you need to know where that is. You got to understand where your film back is, where your focal length is, like how it works with your rack focus or that kind of thing, you know, depth of field, et cetera. You need to understand how to get these skeletal meshes to work with each other, how to attach things to the skeletal meshes. Say you've got something that's on fire, that's moving at really high speeds. How do you make it so that the fire doesn't like lag behind those things? So for me, my job was a lot of generalist knowledge of like, it came from the asset side. And I think that's really important because I knew what were the basic requirements for anything to come into the engine, right? I think at the time on the Witches, it's simple stuff of, you know, Unreal Engine uses DirectX for its normal maps. So if you do OpenGL normal maps, like you would in Unity, everything's flipped. And for example, like there's tiny little details of if you're using packed textures to sort of save on GPU memory, where you have, you know, basically the RGB channels each have like, say, occlusion, roughness, metallic. So you have all of those textures each in one channel. Because you have this packed texture, there's a little option that you need to tick that says use sRGB or not. They need to untick it. If you don't, everything looks wet because the values aren't correct. And we had this on the Witches where, oh, I remember the VFX supervisor saying to us, why does all the wood look wet? You know? And I was like, oh. And then I was like, I had a suspicion. And I remember saying, hey, all the maps need to have the sRGB unticked. And then I went on a call and I said to the folks, I said, hey, you could select all the textures and it's like 500, you know, thousands of textures. And you can imagine someone just going internally screaming when you tell them that they have to go to, you know, 1,000 images and go like untick, you know what I mean? Like you just, that's bad. And I told them like, so, hey, select all your images. You can right click, find a little menu that says bulk edit via property matrix, and then one untick all of it, save it, one click, you're done. And then, you know, that was the thing. So it's this kind of general knowledge of like, oh, we have a flag, or we have a bit of cloth. How do you do cloth physics in Unreal? Can you cache the cloth physics? How do you work with alembics? Because some things that you need, like shattering and really complex things, say coming from Houdini, which we use a lot in Envis as well, to kind of communicate with Unreal, because obviously Epic and SideFX have a sort of like a partnership, right? Understanding how all those systems work is really, really important because then you can put the right person on the job, and that job can be done properly and is stable and like gives you expected results. So for me, I'd say you have to be fairly technical, but at the same time, that's for my job, right? As a real-time supervisor, you are, you know, dealing with the directors, the DOPs, the VFX production. It's your job to take all of this technical complexity and the knowledge that you have and simplify it, because at the end of the day, Unreal is really user-friendly. And once you know all its bits, it's very easy to say, I'm going to drop a cube in. And if I need to measure something really quickly, I know that the cube in Unreal is a meter square. So I can just go scale it up. You know, if I need to, so how tall is that? You just put in, you know, a cube, scale it, and then it's done. Oh, it's 5 meters. And then you convert it to feet or whatever, and you're good to go. So it's sort of a two-sided thing of like, it's really user-friendly to kind of get started. But in order to do things properly and not make a mess and keep things organized and run a solid pipeline, that kind of a nice, well-oiled like machine, you do need to be fairly technical, because I think it's a really important thing that you are realistic with the clients about what can and cannot be done, you know, so that you don't lead them into thinking, oh, this is this magical thing in Unreal where you can do everything. And it's like, you can do everything if you've planned accordingly and you have, you know, say, oh, what are the things that we need to do for this scouting session? Oh, these are the poses for the character. They're going to do this and then they're going to do that. And then I need to know when the, you know, this character grabs onto this railing, like how far his feet, like, is the character's height the right? You know, is this correct to the actor? And, you know, all those kinds of things. So it's sort of, you know, for my side of things, fairly technical, but it doesn't have to be necessarily. You know, Unreal is, like I said, very friendly to use because that's how we've been using it on a day-to-day with, like, say, my current project, right?
Yeah. So do you think non-real-time rendering is could be a thing of the past? I mean, are artists yearning for it?
I think you know the answer to what the artists yearn for, and you know that that is yes. And I think everybody can relate to being home and appreciating being with your loved ones and spending more time with them. And I think anything that takes time and is literally a, like, it is just taking time, if that could be avoided, 100% it should be. So a thing of the past, I don't think so. Not yet anyway. I think there's a lot of amazing technology coming on with lighting and rendering in Unreal, for example, but there are still things that happen where sometimes you see a little bit of ghosting and sometimes there's a little bit of anti-aliasing. They're like, ooh, what's that? There's a flicker there. And you're, ooh, I wasn't expecting that. And there's some like particularities about working within a game engine sometimes that you're like, ooh, these things happen sometimes. Whereas with an offline renderer, it can be a bit more predictable, possibly. It's a different sort of discipline, right? I think it's starting to blur the lines very severely, which I think is a great thing. And I think when you see all the stuff about virtual art departments and the big LED walls, you can clearly see that that is doable. But the amount of preparation and the amount of cost that goes into that, and then you've committed to what you've shot, that's quite... I don't know that every director is going to want to do that. I think that's a fairly lively discussion about it's just more flexibility in green, for example, you know. So I don't think it's a thing of the past, and but I do believe that it needs to be faster because the real-time renderings are really, really close. They're really, really close. You just have to think about, you know, GPU shortages and all this other stuff, and you know, ray tracing is real time, but it's slow in real time, you know. It's like, it's so you're kind of in a halfway house doing that kind of thing with the real-time rendering, where yeah, in certain circumstances it's perfect, it'll like do the job, it'll be editable, it'll be great. But then you still see the pixelation on screen because the rays have to calculate, and you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, it's like you can't get away from the math there. It's sort of like the calculations that need to be done. So it's getting really close, but I still think it'll be, you know, there's some time before it kind of, like, it's definitely blurring the lines very severely, which I think is a good thing because it breeds innovation, right?
Yeah. What would you say your favorite non-real-time renders are and why?
I would say it would have to be Unreal for real-time rendering. And then if you were going to do something like just model displays and things like that, if you're an artist, I think Marmoset has an amazing sort of lighting system that they do in real time. But as far as that, I believe that right now I'd go for Unreal for ease of access and just in general. You know, it depends on what you want to do with it, right? Like, if you're trying to do, you know, really, really high quality stuff in Unreal, you could do PhotoReal in Unreal. You always could do PhotoReal in like stuff in Unreal. You just have to bake your lighting maps and make sure that your UVs are perfect. And then you're cooking all the shadows and the ambient occlusion and doing all the lighting. So you're kind of doing an offline render of the scene, to then look amazing. So you can do it already, you know. So I think it's just, it gives you that flexibility, which I think is really awesome. So I think, for me, like I said, I'm a bit biased because for me, it really changed my life. I gave Unity many, many goes, but as an artist trying to learn how to program, that was very difficult for me. I needed something visual, and the blueprints just kind of helped me a lot, the blueprint system in Unreal. So yeah, like I said, I'm a bit biased about, but I believe that, you know, right now it's very easy to see who's on top, and that obviously would be Unreal.
Right? Yeah, sure. Yeah. Interesting. So we previously and briefly talked about diversification and representation in industry, be race or gender. Just what do you think can be done to achieve this?
I think a lot can be done to achieve this. The most important thing is for people to be proactive about making a change, right? And recognizing that we have an issue of representation in the industry and actively pushing for, different candidates and giving them preference because they need to be given an opportunity. And, you know, not just from their background, but because there's incredibly talented people out there that, like, I understand the argument of saying, oh, you should judge a person by their work, not, you know, the color, the race, the gender. And I completely understand that. But you have to be able to tackle systemic problems, right? You have to be able to engage with those, right? I think I'll give you an example of, like, you know, in Brazil, there's a system that by no means is perfect, and I'm not, like, defending it in any way, but, you know, there's a very big problem with racism in Brazil, for example. And one of the things that the government did was they introduced, like, quotas for universities. And there's many people that go, oh, no, you know, people should just be able to get in on their own merits. It shouldn't matter. And, like, you understand that sentiment. But at the same time, it's like there must be reparations done for the harm of the past. And there has to be some sort of a bridging of the gap because there's such a divide because of the problems in the past with women, people of color, minorities, transgender, now, you know, all this stuff is like, there's damage done. These people are, you know, in a less favorable position. You have to prop them up personally, I think, in some way to help equalize things a little bit. How do you, like, fix decades of an imbalance if you don't try to imbalance it to the other way? That's my view. So for me, when, you know, I think we're trying really hard at Envis to have a lot more representation. I think we have a very, very large amount of women in the company, which I think is awesome, and in leadership positions as well, where we're trying to also foster that talent. It may not sometimes look like it from outside sometimes when you look at companies, but yeah, it's we have a really good sort of representation system, but we're also sort of reaching out to places that specialize in this sort of thing and working with partnerships. And, you know, there's also a really big conversation to be had about neurodiversity, for example. And when I say neurodiversity, it's about, you know, things like dyslexia, you know, and other sort of things in that nature. So, for example, one of my good friends in the company is dyslexic. And for the longest time, I didn't know this. So every time he typed me a message, I used to get really frustrated because I was like, I don't understand what you're trying to say. Like, and then one day he was just saying, yeah, no, it's because I'm dyslexic. And I was like, why didn't you just tell me that this is the case? Because it just changes it completely of, like, I can understand what's going on now. I recently hired a brilliant young artist, and I was basically taking her through. I usually do all the onboarding of my team. I manage a big team of artists now. I think it's about 13 people in total under me on the asset department. Because as a supervisor, a real-time supervisor in the company, I'm also the head of assets. So that's sort of my sort of technical role. Like, I'm across all shows. It's just in this particular instance, I'm supervising a show and sort of still trying to do everything on the side of it. So I was talking to this artist that I hired, and we have really, really good documentation with big images and GIFs and things like that, where, like, step by step how to do things. And I was like, hey, just read the docs. It's all in docs. And I kept saying that. And then I think after the second or third day, I could see she was a bit nervous and was like, what's going on? And she's like, I'm dyslexic. It's really difficult for me to read the documentation. And I was like, you need to tell me this. You know, I need to be able to understand your needs to kind of cater to them. That's what good management does, right? And I think that's also important for diversification when you're hiring, of like understanding there are going to be cultural differences where some, you know, if you have an all white staff and you hire someone, you know, a black person to the company, they might not listen to the same music as everybody else will, for example, and then they will feel completely left out when people are talking about music. It's like, oh yeah, no, I just don't listen to that. And then they might not feel a bit intimidated or shy of like, oh, I mean, I can't really engage here because nobody really listens to what I listen to, for example. So there's a lot of work that can be done in the industry, I think, but the way to do it is to be proactive, and we have to do it. We have to do better because we know that there's a problem, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. 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 So yeah, it really, yeah, I agree. Well, really well said, I think. Yeah, just a bit of feedback. I'm just curious about what you look out for when you're recruiting for either assets or for an unreal artist.
So yeah. For assets, I look for artists who know and understand physically based rendering workflows. So working with Maya, or, you know, in our case it's Maya, but you can be Blender or Max or whatever. You know, you do your modeling, you do your UVs, you bring it into Substance Painter, or, you know, there's Quixel, there's programs like that that do your physically based renders and shading and that kind of thing, and making sure that they understand, you know, proper optimization of assets. Of like, you don't need as many polygons for this, or sometimes you want to have polygons for this, where you don't want to, say, have a normal map where you could just have a bevel on the edge of a table or something like that. So you don't have like cubes to be a table. You can like, I look for artists who have that kind of experience on the technical side of building assets that will go into a game engine straight up without any problems, because they'll integrate immediately into our pipeline very easily. They know how to model, they know how to texture, thus they can bring assets into Unreal and they'll look good, right, immediately. So that's the main thing that I look for as far as like on character artists, for example. Obviously it's a different sort of discipline, but same thing, same basis of knowledge that you need to have, a lot more anatomy, possibly understanding how to do eye shaders, subsurfacing, hair, cloth, you know, marvelous designer, those kinds of things, lots of skills of just building things efficiently. But most importantly, and this is a difficult one to obviously gauge from what you see on portfolio, if it's a previs, speed and how to cut corners and where to cut those corners of like, do you really need this to be a detailed, you know, how big is this texture going to be, etc. So for me, if the portfolio has solid pieces that show that they have the basic understanding of 3D and those kinds of workflows with physically based rendering, they're a perfectly valid candidate for me, and I definitely go for them. So yeah, that's on my side of my department. On the asset side, I just, you know, I look at their work, and if they can build what I need them to build, then I put them on the list, and that's
So what advice would you give to anyone looking to follow your career path?
So I would say that for me, my career path of being a supervisor and managing a team and sort of having all these interactions is you should be just really passionate about what you do, whereas you kind of want to, like, you want to really enjoy what you do. You want to, like, I think my advice is try everything. Try modeling, try rigging, try texturing, try animation, try a little bit of programming, build something like simple, like, you know, try to go through the whole pipeline of it, right? Build a little character, a simple thing, rig it, understand rigging, because it's all about teamwork, right? You're going to interact with people. Your work is going to get picked up by someone else. You want to be respectful when that person picks up your scene, that it is clean, organized. So work cleanly and try everything. So build something simple that is achievable, but go through the whole process of modeling, texturing, rigging, animating, bringing it into the engine, and making it movable, for example. Mm-hmm. And of all those things that you've done, if all of that sounds appealing to you, dear listener, which one do you love the most? And pursue that one. because all of these fields are extremely, you know, deep and you can focus on them. But the generalist knowledge is incredibly powerful and incredibly useful. And, you know, it's that old thing where the saying is, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, but then nobody says the end of it, which is oftentimes better than a master of one, right? And that's the thing. I am not a master of one. I am a jack of all trades. But the thing that I absolutely love is programming. And I found it when I was 30 years old, you know, where I had already had a pretty successful career freelancing as an asset modeler, for example, back in Brazil. And it just completely changed my life. And then what I did is I just pursued my passion. And this isn't a thing. I think it's one of the things that not a lot of people talk about, possibly. And I'm trying not to give it the wrong idea when, you know, a lot of people say, you know, there's a big conversation about crunch in the game industry and in the VFX industry as well. Over time, you know, I think you and I have both seen the posts on LinkedIn where it's like, hey, look, these studios pay for overtime. And it's this thing. And it's like, well, yeah, every studio should pay for overtime. Right. Yeah. It's how it works. Or just don't have it, like we don't. And in this, for example, it's just not a thing. Like, 6:20 every day, you know, because we do 9:30 to 6:30. I hop on this little hangout call that I have with my team, and I say, "Get out, all of you, out now!" Shoot, yeah. And like I just roll up the newspaper and I just chase them around, be like, "Out, out, 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 out."
Yeah.
So that's the thing. There's a really simple way of not having a problematic overtime, policy. Don't do overtime. So have good, you know, work-life balance, like say we do, and you don't have to worry about it, right? And then obviously. So the reason I'm saying that is because I, for a very long time, and I still do, come out of work and I pursue my personal development. I continue to program by myself, build tools in Python. I have my own game that I'm coding in Unreal, and I'm always doing those things. And for me, that's what people don't say that you have to do. You have to put the hours in. You are not going to be able to learn everything you need to learn on the job. You're going to learn a lot, 100%, but you do need to supplement that in your off time. And that doesn't mean work yourself to death or all that stuff. You need to pick something that you like, that you want to do. And hopefully, if you've landed that job, you can have the energy at the end of the day and the passion to do it. It's not easy for artists. It's very difficult to like do art the whole day and then come back to the computer that they've been sitting on for the whole day and do that. For me, I just sort of separate myself where like I have this area here, that's my office, and then I have my laptop and I program in bed. And that's my space, and that's where I get in and I do all my stuff. So for me, nobody really tells students and people who are coming into the industry how much time you actually have to put in to learn all these things, because I think I touched upon some very sort of surface level technical stuff that people might not ever even need to think about considering in Unreal. And it's like, yes, I need to know all of that. You know, I need to know all these systems. I need to understand the limitations of blending animations or, you know, building ones from scratch and what can and you can't do, etc. Pivots are a thing in Unreal. We're like, where are your pivots going to go and how do you set them? And, you know, there's lots that you can research. And the amazing thing is we live in a digital world where there's so much information. So for me, my suggestion is try everything, see what you really like, focus on what you really like, and do not cheap out on your training. Find mentorships. And even if it's expensive, it's an investment in yourself. Save the money up for that, and it will be the best money that you pay. I'm personally, I find that universities and, you know, the degree, they can't keep up with the speed with the industry changes. And I don't recommend that sort of direction for learning VFX or games. You should find very specific technical schools that teach you from A to B. You focus on that. Once you reach the point and you find that you've plateaued, find a mentor and have them guide you forward. And that's how I would do it, because that's how I did. I have a university degree, didn't get me this job, didn't get me any job. So hopefully that's good advice. I'm extremely passionate about teaching and learning and all this other stuff. And believe me, we could have a very long podcast about just education in general, because I think that is a great leveler in a lot of societal problems. But let's not go into politics on your nice VFX artist podcast.
No, I mean, just to probably my last question I had for you, I was just curious about to hear about what your thoughts are in terms of the importance of parental support, especially for yourself, because you you realized that you weren't getting on well
mm-hmm.
with the education system.
Oh yeah.
So how important was it for your parents to identify that you weren't enjoying it, as well as the support that they gave you to then yeah. get you into the space that you ended up?
It was pivotal. Yeah. It was pivotal.
Mm.
Like my for the longest time, I had a very difficult relationship with my father because he was very strict about school, and he said, no, you must study, you must do well, you must do this. And it just, you know, eventually he realized that it wasn't for me, and he understood that, and he wanted the best for me. And so he took me out of the school that like required me to get like 7.5, like from 0 to 10, you have to get 6.5 or 7s or something to pass the year. And he took me out of the school that was like 7.5 or was something, and put me in one that was a 5 to pass. And I started passing, and then I suddenly, because I had such high expectations in the other school, and I used to get like 6.5 or 7s or something, suddenly I'm like one of the best, you know, students in the class, because the expectation is less, right? It's incredibly important and really pivotal that parents support their kids in their endeavors, but also reach out to them to be like, what do you want to do? Or, you know, speak to others to like try to give them guidance, right? Because you're not going to have all the answers. But for me, mm-hmm. 100%, you know, even, you know, like I said, my dad wanted me to go to university. And, you know, we have conversations now, we laugh about it, where he's like, no, son, you were right. You didn't need that. And you were telling me you didn't need that. Mm-hmm. So you finished that degree for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was the thing. And I was like, yeah, dad. But, you know, so I think it's really important that parents try to, if you have someone that's shown interest in the creative side, and that includes programming, because programming is an incredibly creative and like mm-hmm. artistic field in its own right, you need to understand that sometimes, maybe not for programming, but like it's traditional schooling isn't the way to go for artists necessarily, but highly specialized technical training totally is. I think, you know, now that I've learn how to program, and I realize how much math I need to know, in a sense, because I work in a 3D application and everything is matrices and vectors and things like that. It's like, oh, that's where all that math was useful. Wish I had known these practical applications of the fact that literally everything in a 3D world is like, it's just matrices and vertices, mm-hmm. and, you know, I was like, oh, I wish someone had told me that this is practical. Mm-hmm. So now I'm having to teach myself math back, mm-hmm. like, and I love it, because there is a new, like, I think you need to shift the paradigm, right, of like put things into context and give people practical applications for things. I mean, like, this is what you use the math for. See, these are the numbers. This is how you manipulate it. It's like, ooh, that's how you use the math. And so now it's just it's such a joy to sort of rediscover that I really enjoy mathematics, because it's a beautiful thing, you know. And whereas in school, it was like, nah, I hate this. It's not for me. All this stuff. And now I'm like looking back and then, like, man, if I had just realized how important it is, and, you know, it's tricky. Everybody's going to have their own journey, but as far as parental support, absolutely support your kids as much as you can with their dreams, and just be understanding that it isn't a straight line. Sometimes you zigzag until you find yourself, and that's really important. But yeah, my biggest takeaway, I think, would be focus on highly specialized technical training, not university degrees, because mm-hmm. that's where you'll get more success in the industry, I feel.
Yeah, sure, yeah. I mean, not more to add. I think that's the perfect segue to end it. But yeah, really incredible at your journey and just like your passion. Well, would you say it's a passion? I mean, it's like, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I love it. I love this. I love my job. I love what I do, and I love the people I work with. I love my team.
Yeah.
Like the job that I'm, the company I'm at right now, it is a really special place. I feel very lucky to be where I am. I worked really, really hard for it, and I won't, mm-hmm. you know, I won't have false modesty about that.
Yes,
but that's the recipe, right? Anything worth having requires effort. You want to work on yourself. You want to run a 5K. You got to download the app and start.
Yeah.
Running 2 minutes at a time, and then you start running 4 minutes and 8 minutes and 10 minutes and 15 and then by the time you're running 25, you're like, how am I doing this, you know? All it takes is the first step and consistency, discipline, and hard work, and you can get, you know, you can do a lot with that.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Thanks a lot, Felipe.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, mate.
It's been great.
So good to see you.
Yeah, you too.